I'm Tony Robinson. Good to see everybody. Professor at UC Denver, which is about 20 minutes from here, just right across the street is where my office is. And then I'm a co-founder and an organizer with an organization called El Centro Humanitario, which organizes immigrant day laborers and domestic workers here in Denver. So that's probably enough of who I am. So what I want to do, I have no financial things to disclose. Very formal. I'm going to be talking about this from a perspective, not so much from the union perspective, but from a very local small local nonprofit called El Centro Humanitario. This organization was started from this situation right here that you see, which is 10 years ago there was no such center in Denver that served day laborers who stand on the street corner looking for work, many of whom, of course, are undocumented. They're immigrants, come up from south of the border. And so, of course, they're very vulnerable. They're very exposed. The precipitating event to start El Centro was when we used to have a table on the corner every day, just feeding people, talking with them, hearing about their issues, talking about desires for a better situation. One day we showed up at our table early in the morning, and Jose Martinez was there as well, but he was bloodied and laying in the street, and he was seriously brain injured. What had happened is he'd been hired by an employer the day before to do roofing work right off the street. He'd fallen off the roof and cracked his head open, and in the dead of night, the employer had brought him back and disposed of him in the street and just took off. And nobody knew who this employer was or what the situation was. And Jose was brain injured. To this day, when we see him on the street, of course, he hobbles, he can't work, his life is ruined. That was a precipitating event that caused the creation of El Centro Humanitario, which was meant to be an indoor center where workers could come and seek work and also have a variety of other services, English classes, legal representation, a union of sorts, where workers stand together and say, we're not going to work for less than $12 an hour. Nobody who's employed here will work for less than that. So that's kind of how El Centro starts, and it speaks to what we all kind of know, probably, which is this, the Latino workers' experience today, which is they really, Latino workers, immigrant workers, workers of color in general, are right at the front lines of trouble in our economy. Non-Latino workforce fatalities drop in the last 10 years, 15 years really, and of course Latino workers' deaths jump 72%. This isn't just because there's more Latino workers today than there used to be, that's part of it, but the rate of Latino injury is much higher. Today it's at 4.6 deaths per 100,000 workers a year, which is unmatched by any other group of workers, and that grows. That tends to grow each year. They account for 16% of all deaths in the workforce, although they make up only 13% of the workforce. I want to talk a little bit about kind of why that is or what the situation is. You probably all, I mean, one common set of reasons, of course, is that Latino and immigrant workers face a variety of vulnerabilities. Language skills, education levels, the precariousness of the kind of work they do, their legal status, a climate of fear in this group exposes that group to much more troubling workplace situations. But there's two specific work groups that El Centro serves, and that is day laborers and domestic workers, who are heavily immigrant labor in Denver. And both of these are very vulnerable work groups. So you've got the day laborers, people that stand on the street looking for work every day, and domestic workers who are working inside of people's homes behind closed doors. Each group is particularly vulnerable and really beyond the law in terms of safety protections in a lot of ways. Hundreds of thousands of Latino workers are on the street every day, not just Latino, but day laborers on the street every day. And the reality is that formal legal protections and quite often union organizing campaigns have a very hard time reaching this group. We have very little data on the injuries they face. The Census Bureau doesn't track it. The BLS doesn't track a lot of injuries faced by day laborers. OSHA, for the most part, targets larger workplaces for actions. Very rarely you're going to find OSHA action for Jose, one guy who fell off the building and got his head hurt. Language barriers, legal vulnerabilities, very little knowledge of rights in this group, of what their rights are, how to enforce them, and in fact, very unclear responsibilities. If you're hired at a temporary labor place, kind of who then is responsible if you get injured? Is it the temporary labor place, or is it the employer who went through the temporary labor place? OSHA itself is kind of mixed on this. It's very hard to reach these. These are all day laborers. Now, add to that, domestic workers are also aren't tracked. How many injuries they face, they have language barriers, they have legal vulnerabilities because they tend to be immigrants, often undocumented, but they have something else. Here's what OSHA says in its regulations regarding domestic workers. As a matter of policy, individuals who in their own residences privately employ persons for ordinary household tasks, cleaning, cooking, caring for children, shall not be subject to the requirements of OSHA. So they're specifically excluded as a group that can get any protection from OSHA in terms of workplace health and safety. Now, that's a little troubling because you might think, and you mentioned we tend to think people that maybe work in a chicken factory or something face dangers, but of course a lot of other workers face, as you mentioned, it isn't just those hardcore jobs that face dangers. When you look at domestic workers, we did a survey here in Denver of 400 domestic workers, and there's very little research into this group surveying them of like what dangers do you face. But that's just an example of those 400 domestic workers of what's happened to them in the previous year. Sleeping in unhealthy locations like basements without windows, seriously injured. 40% say they think they have faced serious health damages. There's been formal studies such as this Journal of Occupational Environmental Medicine, which shows that a large percent of these asthma cases, 12% of the confirmed cases of asthma in these four states were associated with exposure to cleaning products. Mostly women 45 years of age and older, most of them being white non-Hispanic, but that other, but the other group here, for almost 30% were Hispanic. So, all of this is meant to project the problem. Some of the solutions that we commonly talk about when dealing with this these issues are to change the law, of course. We need better law to protect day laborers. They need to be incorporated into OSHA. There needs to be more investigators in OSHA. There's very few OSHA investigators actually out there. The problem with these kind of solutions, especially when you're talking day laborers and domestic workers, is it's not going to happen. It's slow and unrealistic. We're not going to find a big legal change in the coming years or a whole bunch of new OSHA investigators out there targeting these groups. It's not going to happen. So that they are what's defined as hard-to-reach workers that the law is not going to protect in this way. In fact, OSHA just came out, even under Obama and all the changes we have with the Democratic administration, his administration just came out with a new report of, you know, celebrating OSHA at 40, and I went through and read this report, and it was funny because the first few pages of the report are all about how hopeless OSHA is. After saying, this is great, we're 40 years old, but here's some quotes from that. We're a small agency, we don't have enough enforcement tools, we don't have any fines, we can't protect workers from retaliation, our process is slow, on and on, saying basically we understand that we're a very weak organization, as you also mentioned in your report. You know what I forgot to bring up? Sorry, people, is my clock. I want to be sure I don't take more than my time.
No, she's got a...
Oh, you will? Thank you. So I'll be watching you. Tell me when there's like five left. So one solution, which is literally command and control changes in the law, is not really likely to happen and is not going to make much of a difference. A second kind of important solution is labor organizing, which we just heard about. Even in the absence of big legal change, unions make a huge difference across the board, and they can create action even in the absence of, you know, formal legal changes. Of course, the problem with this group is we're talking domestic workers who work one-on-one in individual homes. Very hard to organize that labor force. And day laborers. Even though day labor centers are increasingly frequented and funded by union locals who help these immigrant day labor centers, understanding that these aren't the competition necessarily, but as a workforce to be organized, the problem is when you've got a transient, irregular, hidden workers moving from state to state, it's very unlikely that traditional organizing campaigns are going to, it's hard to reach them. So the point of this is that some of these traditional solutions don't work well for this labor force. So I want to talk about a little bit of a third way that I've been involved in, which has been promising. And it's not this legacy model of kind of command and control. We need new big government lawmaking and rule enforcement. It's not even reliance on traditional union organizers to protect workers, but it's a little less high profile and a kind of more nimble use of government authority. Authority that people like President Obama have to kind of redirect government money in some unique ways that empower these alternative community-based organizations, not unions per se, but like immigrant rights organizations, public education, Latino advocacy organizations. And I'll point out exactly how these can be play a huge role in workplace safety and how it's happening more currently, in fact. Obama administration, this is just one example. This last year, has been using their grant-making authority creatively to target these underserved groups, even without dramatic changes to OSHA or new laws. They've just taken the executive power and kind of redirected where grants go to target these hard-to-reach workers. And one of the leading group grant campaigns that does this is the Susan Harwood Training Grant Program that provides grants to basically train and educate workers on health and safety. So we get to, as you said, we got this model too often sometimes of workers are responsible for their safety. And there is trouble in that. But the Harwood grant does target, like, here's how workers can be made more aware of how to protect their own safety and advance their rights. There's a variety of eligible applications, private groups, unions, universities, and community-based nonprofits. What is different this year from previous years is a substantial redirection of funds, and this is a quote from Obama's group, administration, to reach out to the most vulnerable and hard-to-reach workers, including immigrants and non-English speakers, especially those employed in high-hazard industries. Now, the grant has always targeted those kinds of groups, but they've specifically, under Obama, said, we're going to even increasingly redirect our attention to groups like day laborers and domestic workers, who OSHA even says is not targeted by OSHA regulations. But we can direct our grant money to help educate these groups. In fact, I was part of, they invited day labor organizations from across the nation to show up in Washington, D.C. before these grants were due and said, we want to get this money out to day laborers. So how can we help your organization to write a better grant to produce? And it was an education campaign reaching out to groups that had never before received this kind of money, trying to bring them into this system. I want to take a little bit of a side here and talk about the ironic role of George W. Bush in making this happen. Not a big workplace safety, let's get more money to, you know, immigrant workers kind of president. But what's interesting is when he, in 2001, when he became president, he issued a report saying, this Harwood money is going to too many unions. You know, the unions are getting the money and that's horrible. And it's biased toward these legacy recipients, and every year they give the money to the CWA, to the AFL-CIO. This isn't fair. So they rewrote the rules under him to say, here's how the past rules read. It required that you had to have past managerial experience with these grants. So it kind of, you know, kept the same people continuing to get the grant. So George Bush said, no, this is unfair. We need a more broadly welcoming policy that gets new groups involved. And so he rewrote the rules. And following his report in 2001, Labor Secretary Elaine Chao rescinded $5 million that went to unions and redirected that money to 61 different groups, kind of spread it out, many of them being employer groups. Probably this union-busting group you talked about, maybe got some of the money, I don't know. A very cynical effort, actually, to get some of that money to employers and to business groups because they know about safety. And in fact, in 2007, he tried to get rid of the program altogether. He just tried to eliminate it. So it was a very cynical, like, let's get rid of this. He wasn't able to get rid of it. But the legacy that continued was this idea that the grant should go to these non-legacy groups sometimes. And the creative thing that happens there is it creates this new flexibility in grant making that has now allowed the Obama administration to say, great, we can, you've just kind of laid that we can target it to these new groups that don't have a lot of experience, so we're going to get it to day labor centers and domestic worker unions. And that's just what they've done. So the 2001 grant said we're going to target pilot programs, small community organizations, the largest percentage of funds ever to non-union immigrant groups in precarious high-work informal sectors, all designed to reach Spanish speakers. These are not large grants. But when you give $1 million or $200,000 or $100,000 to a small local nonprofit like El Centro, it makes a huge difference in the work they can do to reach out to their population. There's Rush. I think this is funny because as soon as this notice went out, these organizations that were funded with this money, I was listening to the radio the other day, like a couple days afterwards, our organization was one of them, and sure enough, Rush Limbaugh, national radio, was hammering the Susan Harwood grant program, an obscure little government program. This is the picture from his website, like, what? They're giving money to, you know, immigrants and undocumented people. And he was really, you know, went through like 20 minutes on this grant program, which says that he understands there may be some, even though there's small grants, it means something real that this is where the money's going. Here's his transcript talking about all the, you know, clergy and lady, United for Economic Justice, farm worker legal services, Hispanic Resource Center. Stick with me on this, he says. I got some more to go. And he lists through all these horrible organizations that he can't stand. Alliance of Forest Workers, Casa Latina, Center for Human Services, Farm Worker Legal Services. Drove him nuts that these organizations were getting the money. And in fact, these were all first-year grantees last year. These are smaller community nonprofits that are getting this kind of serious money to do their work. And this is El Centro, which was the organization I work with that did get part of this money to target and reach these hard-to-reach workers with health and safety training. Well, what does it mean? How? Oh, there he is again. He's still confused. Funded activities of what we do with this money, just to get a sense of what the kind of stuff it does and how it tries to reach these hard-to-reach workers. You start with just literally fundamentally reaching out and telling, having them tell their stories. So we can recognize that domestic workers, in fact, face serious problems on the job, and so do day laborers. And this is anybody that wants, well, I don't know anybody, because I don't, our photocopier, you know, busted as I was copying them. But I got copies of one of the first things that came out of this, and this is a systematic survey of the experience of domestic workers in Denver, of their health and safety, and all other wages, how often they're abused and beaten and raped, and all the things that happened to them. And it took a lot to go out and survey 400 people in the street, at bus stops, in laundromats, say, what exactly are you facing? And you start there by just exposing, and we're going to have, you know, a Colorado press conference, it's going to be on Colorado Public Radio, of helping domestic workers understand the situation they face. So I've got copies of these, and it's also the full color version can be maybe mailed to people that might be interested. But if you'd like to see that, you can. So you start with those. Let me get to each of these other things in a minute. Digital storytelling and peer training, and then public outreach and change, and then I'll wrap it up. But so there's the survey and needs assessment. We put out the report, and on the heels of the report, these women, sorry, that you see here, Green Cleaning for Life, it was also an organizing campaign. So at the same time that we're funded doing the survey and outreach, it funds organizing the workers on health and safety issues. So these were about 10 domestic workers who were individuals working in houses. And they came together through this grant, through this organizing campaign. We kind of led up to it, and they're going to be funding what's called Green Cleaning for Life. It's a worker-owned co-op, where they own their business, and they're working collectively to provide domestic service. And connected together, we're quite confident they're going to have a different standard of life and a more health situation on the job coming out of this. So it funds organizing and advocacy to these hard-to-reach workers. It funds a series of what's called digital storytelling and peer training, where we've got real money, where we hire workers themselves, day laborers, to go out and talk with other day laborers on camera. What goes on in the job site? What's happening to you? What have you faced? What have you done to avoid dangers? How do you talk to your employer? And all of that being filmed. This is one of the staff here talking to one worker about his experiences. Then we turn it into a short film, and then those films are used when you bring other workers in at an organization they're comfortable with. El Centro is a day labor center. You walk in there early in the morning at 6 a.m. It's all a bunch of immigrant workers. There's coffee and donuts, TV if they want to watch it. It's just their little center. And here's a place where they're comfortable receiving safety training. And especially when it's films about their friends, kind of talking what they face. So it just raises the level of understanding. We're modeling it on a group like this. This is UNIDO's final report. All of these YouTube videos are little videos they've built, just 10-minute videos of the stories of day laborers and what they face on the job, and they're really quite powerful. And this grant funds getting that information out there, filming it, putting it up on the web, and reaching workers in a very creative way. So that's a second thing we're doing with these videos to reach people. And then public outreach and advocacy, you know this, right? So this is what a lot of this is modeled on, at least at El Centro, is it's very difficult to organize domestic workers who, you know, work behind doors in people's houses. But not impossible. In New York has kind of led the way of kind of reaching out to these workers, doing a report of their situation, and building it into a union, a domestic workers union that is pushing for the first time in the nation to have a domestic worker bill of rights that spells out in law that these workers have minimum wage rights, maximum hour rights, and certain safety responsibilities of their employers. They have the right to ventilation when they sleep. None of that was in the law before. New York became the first state in the union just several months ago to pass the first domestic workers' bill of rights, which is now law in New York, governing their health and safety and many other things. Our idea is to do the same thing here in Colorado, and that this would not be possible without, you know, literally just a couple $100,000 from the federal government isn't a ton of money, but supporting this kind of organizing on the ground. So again, I think it's very powerful what government can do to make this happen. They don't have to do it with huge money. You don't have to do it with changing the law, but you can do it with creative executive action to just literally say, we're going to reach this segment of the workforce. We're going to rechannel the money to a new segment that hasn't been reached before. It's going to happen below the radar screen, but it'll have profound implications for improving the health and safety of these hard-to-reach workers.